Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. As we await further news on the state of our democracy in November, there's a primary in California this week, and locally there are a ton of fascinating measures and seats newly up for grabs. We're going to preview some of the most hotly contested races, and we're also going to answer your questions about this election with our panel of local political experts. So, grab that voter guide that's been sitting by the front door and remember that the highest impact elections are often local. This is our big primary preview coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Before we get into the meat of the show, just wanted to thank everybody who came out for Night of Ideas at the San Francisco Public Library this weekend. Great event. So happy to see so many of you in the auditorium. And I just want to say all of us here really love doing that show live for you. But after the dreamy weekend, we've got to dig back in on the big political moment here locally. Tons of controversial local measures, big seats up for contention, and several signature initiatives from Governor Newsom and San Francisco Mayor Breed, among others. So we've got a full house this morning, bringing you news from around these Bay Area counties all the way to Sacramento. We're joined by Guy Marzorati, reporter and producer on KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Welcome, Guy.
Hey, good morning.
We've got Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, reporter and producer covering politics with KQED. Welcome, Joe.
Yo.
Annalise Finney, another reporter with KQED, covering the East Bay and other things. Thanks for joining us, Annalise.
Good to be here, Alexis.
And we've got Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks. Good morning.
So, Kim, let's start with you. You've been tracking elections for a long time. What's new and different or interesting this year?
Yeah, this is my 30th year with the California Voter
Foundation. All right, congratulations.
Thank you. We continue to provide online information to voters, nonpartisan, on our website at calvoter.org. I think the headline for me that's different this year is this is the first presidential primary where every registered voter was mailed a ballot. And as your fellow guests on the show know, that this is a complicated primary because we have a closed or partially ajar presidential primary, and the rest of the contests are open, and a lot of people who are registered, no party preference. So there's a good chance people got ballots in the mail that didn't have any presidential candidates on them, or maybe didn't have the ones they were expecting, and that can definitely contribute to some voter confusion.
Yeah. Also, by all accounts, it looks like turnout is, like, abysmal.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. I mean, the difference between this presidential primary and the last two is that this one is not competitive in the way that 2016, 2020 was. And so, but we are part of the Super Tuesday election, and that brings a national frame to our election, which can help motivate voters to participate. And I do think, you know, there's still, you know, some up in the air elements to both the Democratic and presidential and Republican primaries. So I hope that will entice voters to participate. Plus, there are all those down ballot contests that you mentioned that are so important. There are, you know, supervisorial contests, legislative contests, local measures. So there's a lot to inspire people to want to come out and vote tomorrow. Yeah. And I hope they will.
KQED correspondent Guy Marzorati, what are some of the big statewide things people should be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S. Senate primary is a big one. We haven't had a quote-unquote competitive race like this in more than 30 years, and I think there is an increasing likelihood that there might only be one ticket out for a Democrat, and I think that would mean an uncompetitive general election. So that's
what do you mean by that? Let's walk it through.
Look, I think we went into this thinking Adam Schiff and Katie Porter, two Congress members from California, would be the strongest potential candidates.
Wait, why not Barbara Lee, our local?
You know, Barbara Lee is I think a number of reasons. She's kind of struggled from the jump to raise money, and this has been an incredibly expensive race. When you see Schiff spending $24 million just since the start of the year, Porter spending more than $10 million, like this has turned into the type of race where you might need that type of money. Barbara Lee came into this not having really run a competitive race, not having had a national fundraising profile, and I think that has held her back at points. Now, what's emerged in the last few months, though, is Steve Garvey has really consolidated the Republican vote. And I think that's led to a scenario where at least recent polling shows Schiff and Garvey as the most likely candidates to make it into November, which would mean a kind of maybe uncompetitive general election, just given the general makeup of voters in California being such a blue state.
Because it's basically just top two regardless of party, right?
Two regardless of party. And because of that, you've seen a lot of games being played over the course of the primary with Schiff running ads. 60% of the ads that Schiff has run since the start of the year feature Garvey. Now, you may say, why? Well, he really wants to get Garvey's name ID up. He wants Republicans to see Steve Garvey for weeks and weeks on their television in order to prop up his candidacy and to make sure that he doesn't end up in a general election with Katie Porter.
Because is the perception that the Katie Porter Schiff would be a fairly close matchup?
Yeah, I think there you'd see kind of the fissures of, you know, the way the Democratic Party coalition breaks down. Schiff may be more of the establishment, moderate Democrat, Porter trying to draw in more progressive votes, which would be a lot easier in a November election where maybe the turnout is a little higher, especially among younger voters. And from the Schiff campaign, a general election against Steve Garvey would be very favorable, right? You're just drawing on the numbers, the fact that Republicans only make up, you know, roughly a quarter of voters in the state. I think that's a general election that the Schiff campaign has been seeking from the outset of this race.
Let's talk about Prop 1, lay it out for people who haven't been paying attention, and then, you know, kind of where are we on it?
Yeah, so Proposition 1 was put on the ballot last year by the legislature, but really this was Governor Gavin Newsom's biggest initiative of 2023. He really wanted to put this on the ballot in order to get more people who are suffering from, you know, mental health challenges, substance abuse challenges, off of the streets and into housing. Now, the measure breaks down in a couple ways. It's a $6.38 billion bond to build residential treatment facilities and supportive housing, but it also changes the existing Mental Health Services Act. Big picture, it shifts money from mental health services towards housing. So it's really about, you know, Newsom's bet is we need to prioritize, you know, there's a lot of mental health needs run the gamut, right? You can be talking about peer support, depression, anger management class. There's mental health services is a broad thing. What Newsom is saying is the focus should really be on people who have severe mental health issues, schizophrenia, that are basically living on the street or at risk of living on the street. So it's like, let's focus our state resources on this very specific population. Now, that's gotten a lot of pushback from a few different corners.
Yeah, well, who are the corners? Who are the people who are pushing back and how are they pushing back?
Yeah, so I'll break it down into three pieces. On the bond side, you have kind of traditional fiscal conservatives saying, like, you know, we're borrowing, the state has this big deficit. Why should we be borrowing, you know, over $6 billion? It's going to be roughly $9 billion when you have to pay it back for interest. They're just kind of against that sort of thing. But you also have civil libertarians against the bond who feel like this is just going to fund too many locked facilities and it's ultimately going to take the state back to really the genesis of this whole problem was when the state mental hospitals got closed. And it was like there was never a follow-up. Okay, where the people that are in the mental hospitals when Reagan closed them, where are they going to actually live? So they would say, you know, this bond pushes us back towards that era. And then on the Mental Health Services Act reform side, you have, you know, counties, service providers who say, this is not increasing the funding that's coming in. This is not a new tax. So you're looking at the same pot of money and you're putting more of it towards housing. So where are you putting less of it towards?
And that could mean, you know, youth programs, that could mean peer
youth
counseling.
Programs, peer counseling, drop-in counseling. Yeah, anger management, you know, it runs the gamut. But those are the type of programs they say, like, if Prop 1 passes, you know, those could be on the chopping block. Newsom says that's not the full picture. You know, there's initiatives to try to get Medicaid, health plans to pay more into mental health services. Maybe that changes the equation a little bit, but is it unknown?
Yeah. We're talking about what's on the March primary ballot here in Guy Marzorati, correspondent with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the March primary ballot or voting? Is there a local election you have questions about, you know, an individual race? You can email those questions to forum@kqed.org. You can find us on all the social channels, including our digital community on Discord, or you can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6789. 8-6. Any questions that Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, Annalise Finney, and Guy Marzorati from KQED could answer, or Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation? That number is 866-733-6786. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, but talk to me about thematically kind of what you've been seeing. You largely cover San Francisco, but you're obviously, you know, looking at the Bay broadly.
Yeah, in San Francisco in particular, crime is really on the ballot. And we've seen that echoes of that throughout the Bay too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, people are afraid right now. It may not be tied to statistics depending where you live. In San Francisco, for instance, the crime stats have gone up and down and they're nowhere near the violent crime rates of the 1990s. But still, people are feeling afraid. So we're seeing politicians respond to that on San Francisco's ballot with different measures that address public safety. Yeah.
Well, and in parts of the East Bay, like in Oakland, it has been, Annalise Finney, like, crime's been pretty bad and reached levels that I don't think even people thought could be reached again, given the increasing wealth in the city.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we don't have it on the same ballot in the same way that San Francisco does this year. I mean, there's kind of this specter of this attempt to recall the district attorney hanging over everything, but that hasn't qualified for the ballot yet. So what we're seeing is something pretty different. A lot of it is about institutional change, these longtime politicians, some of whom are just retiring because they've been there for decades, and some who are terming out, opening up seats for potential newcomers.
Yeah. So just to get this sort of perspective Pamela Price recall out of the way, people aren't voting on that this time.
No, they're not voting on that this time. It has not yet qualified for the ballot.
Yeah. It's so, you know, these recalls have become like an ever greater part of what it is to like vote here. And there are some measures, right, for Alameda County to say, okay, we're going to change our recall rules because now they've come to our county, even though we haven't had a recall election for 30 years. And my understanding, right, is that basically, the way that Alameda County is supposed to do a recall based on the county books is now no longer possible because of state rules.
That's right. So in Alameda County, the last time we had a recall was more than 30 years ago, and the rules we have on the books were written in the 1920s. So they were written for a county that was about a quarter of the size it is today. So the timelines that the registrar has to tabulate votes are very short compared to what he says he would need now to calculate the votes for the current population of the county. And then there's other things, like there are provisions that the county council says have been overruled in other parts of the state that are likely illegal here, but are just on the books because the county hasn't done the housekeeping to update that. So that measure you're talking about is Measure B, and the idea is the county is asking citizens whether they want to change the county rules just to match the state county rules.
Joe, when we get back from the break, I'm going to want to talk to you about it's not exactly a recall, but judges oftentimes in San Francisco didn't get run against. And now you've got organized campaigns running against judges who are seen as being too lenient on crime, which is another part of this theme that we're seeing here. We're talking about what's on the March primary ballot with Annalise Finney, reporter at KQED, Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, also with KQED, KQED correspondent Guy Marzorati, and Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. We're going to start getting to your calls and comments as soon as we can this morning. Questions that you have about the primary ballot or local races that you're really interested in. I'm sure you've been getting the mailers just like we have. You can email your comments to forum@kqed.org or give us a call at 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back with more with this big KQED team right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the March primary ballot. We are joined by KQED's Annalise Finney, Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, and Guy Marzorati, as well as Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. Let's bring in Steve in San Mateo. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Alexis. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Sure. So I'm just wondering about the Senate seats that are on the ballot. So we have two Senate seats. One of them is a full term, and a second is partial term. And I wonder if you could explain to us why that is and how we should consider those two positions compared to one another.
Mm. Hey, thank you, Steve. Kim Alexander?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is what we saw on our ballots in 2022 when Senator Alex Padilla was on the ballot. He had been appointed to fill the vacancy left when Kamala Harris was elected vice president. And then a law was passed in California the next year to say that if you have a vacancy in a Senate seat, that it needs to be filled by election. And so the law didn't say if there's only a little bit of time left in that seat, by the time the election comes around, you don't have to have an election. So we had the same thing happen in 2022 as we have this year, which is that a seat became open. In this case, it was Senator Feinstein who passed away while still in office, while there was still a little bit of time left in the term. So that U.S. Senate seat that had been occupied by Senator Feinstein would have been on the ballot this election anyway. So it's an open seat. And then in addition, the remainder of the term is up for election as well. And that's that partial term that in reality is only going to be occupied by the winner for a couple of weeks before the full term seat takes the position. So you can vote for the same candidate in both races. You can vote for different candidates in those two races. But either way, we're going to see a repeat of this ballot again in November when there's that top two runoff.
And this might be niche, but I'm going to follow this tomorrow night. Does Barbara Lee's short term vote outpace her vote for the 6-year term? In other words, like, are there progressives out there who are like, I really like Barbara Lee, but the fact that she's 77, I'm not voting for her for a full year term? I think maybe that could lend an insight into reasons why progressives might have been shifting away from Barbara Lee if, you know, we see tomorrow night her getting a lot more votes for that short term.
Further proof, guy watches everything. Steve over on the Discord, Joe, coming back to you. Are there any good resources in general to assess the judges? I always struggle to figure out which judges I want to vote for and against. I want to remind folks, too, we did an entire show on judicial elections and whether or not they're a good idea. I think perhaps the short answer from that show was maybe not, but we do it. So, Joe, how do you do it? How do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, I'd love to point people to our KQED California Voters Guide. I mean, that's on the website. First thing you click on it, there it is. But that's actually one of the things that this group, you know, you may agree or disagree with this group, Stop Crime SF, which we can talk about a little bit more later, who kind of went in and watched all the judges and evaluated them with a report card. But the whole point of them coming in was saying, like, hey, we actually have no window into what you do. It's very difficult. And when you talk to the judges, I ask, well, how do you recommend people evaluate how you do what you do? And they say, well, come in, sit in, watch us.
Do they actually say that? Or they say, like, I don't actually.
They did. Come and watch us. Like, but if you got a 9-to-5 job, that's a little hard, right? It is very difficult. And I think that your Steve there on the Discord speaks to that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's go to Arash in Benicia with a local measure. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about, I'm a resident of Benicia, which is a small town in kind of the deep east bay. And
beautiful Benicia.
There's a measure on the beautiful Benicia, there's about 30,000 of us that would agree. I hope more. And there's a measure B on the ballot that is trying to, like, protect Benicia and establish a sales tax measure, I believe, and also help keep, money in Benicia with, you know, kind of the restrictions of residential growth here. I was just curious, does anybody have any opinions on what a yes vote or a no vote, how that would impact, like, a resident here?
Hmm. That's an interesting question. Thank you, Rush. I mean, I think, Guy, maybe we can come to you on how one would go about kind of investigating, particularly for a smaller city where there's not going to be a huge amount of information that's available. Like, what are the best ways to kind of go about this?
Yeah, so I will say Measure B, we do feature that in the voter guide, so check it out. We have, like, yes and no arguments for that. I think for a sales tax, you're talking about something that's going to be general purpose. So you might hear in the course of the campaign, like, this is for, you know, protecting police or protecting fire. At the end of the day, like, that could be spent on anything. A lot of cities will pass, like, an expenditure plan along with the sales tax to say, look, we're promising you, like, if you give us this vote on this sales tax, we're going to spend it in this way. But yeah, it's, they're not, they won't be restricted by law forever to be doing that. So
it looks like the one restriction is there is a sunset date of 12 years. So,
right. So then they'd have to go back to voters again. And in this case, in Benicia, like, you know, you have a lot of local officials for that, you know, they have a huge endorsement list in support of Measure B. But this is one, and I would say this broadly for sales tax or just taxes in general on the ballot. As like we started the show with, this electorate that we're seeing older voters, more conservative voters outpace younger voters in early returns, I would wonder about these kind of measures would be like potentially in jeopardy, I think.
Talking about March's primary ballot, feel free to give us a call with your questions or the local races that you're watching. 866-733-6786, or you can email forum@kqed.org. Let's bring in David in San Francisco. Welcome, David.
Hey, good morning. So I was reading last night that returns in San Francisco, only 60,000 completed ballots so far. It's pretty low. The author had speculated that because, you know, there's this lack of enthusiasm among progressives for the presidential election, Joe Biden, and all of this red meat for, quote unquote, more conservative voters in the form of the local ballot initiatives, that that may be depressing turnout in progressive areas and elevating turnout in conservative areas. But I'd love for you folks to speculate also on why this might be happening and whether we should expect to see those numbers go up today and tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I could speak to, you know, statewide, this is, you know, a good way to think about it. Seniors, like folks 65 and older, and then voters under 35 make up almost the exact same proportion of California's electorate, each about a quarter. In terms of who had sent their ballot back before today, the seniors had sent back 57% of ballots compared to 8% for people under 34. So that's, again, that's not San Francisco, that's statewide, but that gives you a sense of like the total disproportionate ballot returns that we're seeing that could impact things, you know, like ballot measures, local races.
Yeah, and in San Francisco, I mean, I just looked at the updated numbers on the SF Election site, 74,000 now, which is still 15%, still very low. You know, what we could see that mean is that, you know, efforts to raise more taxes or to like the housing bond, that could very well be defeated because, you know, those conservative, more conservative voters, those older voters, you know, they're homeowners. They don't want to see another bond where they're going to see their, you know, taxes raised in order to have to pay that back. And that could also mean that the public safety measures where people responding to worries about crime, where they go, you know what, I feel unsafe. And those voters tend to say yes to those things. Hmm.
And just to jump in here on what Guy was saying about younger voters, I've been talking with younger voters in Alameda County. And a lot of them did express sort of feeling dismayed about their presidential options. I think people who came out for Joe Biden in the prior election are feeling like he hasn't delivered on climate change in the way they wanted. And for younger people who are really future focused, that's a big issue. And I think some of the younger voters I spoke to were really energized about Barbara Lee and have been dismayed by how poorly she's been polling. So I think for that generation, the kind of under 35-year-old vote, that might be playing a part of this low turnout too.
He did deliver some climate legislation for people, you know?
He
did. That'd be one area where might feel stronger. Want to point people to kqed.org/voter guide. We've got the voter guide there, a huge team effort here at KQED that you might want to check out. Let's talk, Annalise, about some of these big races in the East Bay. First, let's do maybe the U.S. House of Representatives race, District 12. Tell us about that race.
Well, that's Barbara Lee's old seat, of course, and a bunch of candidates lined up for that. But very early on, there was a front runner, and that's Latifah Simon.
She seemed to have swept the field of experienced kind of political competition.
She did. And, you know, some of the other candidates were quite upset about that. I think some people felt that the Democratic establishment lined up behind Latifah Simon really before this campaign even began. And some people felt that, you know, that feels like the establishment choosing a candidate as opposed to leaving it up to voters to choose. There really weren't kind of well-watched debates between the different candidates, and I think some people feel frustrated by that.
I mean, maybe this is just like a somewhat, it's not even a cynical take about local politics, but like, doesn't every local politician try and push out all the people who are going to run against them? Isn't that like...
Oh, there's a lot of, like, the torch passing game is strong. Like the, I mean, even think about like the way people decide not to run. You saw a lot of that in December where it's like it got right up to the deadline. You saw that in some congressional races, some supervisor races in the East Bay where it was like, you get right up to that deadline to decide not to run. And then you're like, okay, I'm not running. Okay, now you give people 3 days to decide, I want to run for this seat, I want to figure out the rest of my life. in a lot of those cases, you have to think they have someone in mind. They've given that person the heads up. Yeah. I'm going to decide not to run. And you saw that, in Keith Carson.
Yeah, that's Keith Carson was an Alameda County supervisor who retired after more than 30 years, and he retired just a few days before the deadline and set off a mad scramble, just like.
And so, who's in that scramble?
That scramble has a bunch of different people who are already involved in politics in the East Bay. There's city council members from Emeryville, Oakland. In Oakland, it's Nikki Fortunato Bass, the city council president. There's also folks from Berkeley City Council. It's a pretty big race itself. And we'll see. I mean, there's no incumbent, so it's a pretty open field.
Right. We got Ben Bartlett, Berkeley City Council member, John Bowders, who's has a strong Instagram game, is what people have been saying about his political fortunes. And Nikki Fortunato Bass. Yeah. So there's so many of these local elections do feel like they are getting more money playing in them than you might guess. And the best example of that seems to be State Senate District 7, right? So this is, tell us about District 7 race.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. This race has had more third-party independent expenditure funding than any other race in this state. Last I checked, it was nearing the $6 million mark. And it's interesting to look at who's donating, because when you do, it sort of begins to look like there's a bit of a proxy war happening here between Uber and unions. I mean, Uber, the rideshare company, is famously big for their support of the gig economy, and unions don't like that because a lot of people who work in the gig economy don't have the same protections as unionized workers. So what we're seeing in that race is Catherine Leibarger, who's the president of the California Labor Federation, getting a ton of support from unions and a lot of opposition from Uber. Uber is also heavily funding Jesse Areguin, who's the mayor of Berkeley, in his candidacy.
And then we've got a couple other folks, too, Rex. We also have Jovanka Beckles, who's been running for stuff. We have Dan Kalp, who's an Oakland City Council member, former assembly member, Sondre Swanson. Like, that is like such a wild race.
Yeah.
Levels of spending, like, how much more spending is this race getting than a kind of normal Senate?
Oh, I mean, I think I think in most really competitive state legislative campaigns, you can expect maybe like $1 million of outside spending. The fact that this is, as Annalise said, approaching $6 million in a primary, this is the most outside money in a primary since the top two system started in 2012. Wow. It's insane. But I would say this race is probably like the poster child example when you think about what the top two primary has given us in California in terms of benefits. Imagine if this election was, the old way, where one Democrat and one Republican make it into the general election. You'd really have a month or two campaign for voters to figure out the person that would then go on to represent this district for 12 years. I think the top two primary gives voters a much longer runway to evaluate different kinds of Democrats. I mean, this is as Democrat a district as you can get. So I think the top two primary now gives us another 6 months to evaluate two of these Democrats going forward.
Let's talk about another fascinating race, this for U.S. House District 16. So this was Anna Eshoo's district. There are strong candidates here. Talk to me about them.
Yeah, so this is another like changing of the guard election. You have Anna Eshoo having held that seat for decades. So when she goes, there's just this pent up demand for local politicians in the South Bay to throw their hat in the ring. You have former San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo, County Supervisor Joe Simidian, and Assemblymember Evan Lowe are like the three elected officials who have represented broad parts of the district. But then it's just an incredibly deep field. Julie Lithcott-Hames, a Palo Alto City Council member, best-selling author. You have Peter Dixon, who is a former Marine and tech entrepreneur, who has poured in a ton of money, almost like approaching $2 million spending. And if you're in the South Bay, you've seen his ads all over the place. He was buying ads during the 49er games, which are incredibly expensive, just to get his image out there. And so this is another one where it's, going to be most likely two Democrats make it into the general election. And there you might start to see some more. I mean, the candidates haven't really gone after each other too much. I think there you might just start to see some more fissures.
I mean, do we have, I think people are like, the polling. But on a race like that, there's not really any public polling, right? So does anyone have any idea like where
No, it's a lot of internal polling, which can be really good. But, you have to take it kind of for what it is. And I think the quality of polling gets more difficult as you get to a smaller and smaller sample of voters. So, you know, in this race, I think, again, things like name identification, people who voters might have been familiar seeing on a ballot. Liccardo, you know, he had two terms as San Jose mayor. More than a third of the voters potentially on Tuesday will be in San Jose. So they know his name. I think those kind of things make it really difficult, honestly, for a candidate to jump in for the first time if they don't have a ton of money to just like introduce themselves, right? Just to have voters like, here, this is who I am.
Yeah, yeah. We've got another kind of voting question here. A listener writes in to say, what is a county central committee and what does it do? I always see it on ballots with lots of candidates, but what is it? Kim Alexander, president and founder of California Voter Foundation.
Yeah, that's one of those contests, kind of like the judicial contests that leave voters scratching their heads. It's really sort of an inside ball position. It's meant for the political parties in each county. And you can only vote in those contests if you're registered with that party. So it's similar to the presidential election. And, you know, a lot of these contests that voters are asking about are difficult to find reliable information. I just wanted to mention a couple sources in addition to the wonderful
KQED voter
guide. Yes, and in addition to
which can be found at kqed.org/voter guide. Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And really, hats off to all of you. It's amazing what you do for voters in your region. They're so lucky to have this resource. And nonpartisan journalism, nonpartisan journalism in general is really where we urge voters to go. There's also Cal Matters has a voter guide that's terrific. I mentioned our guide at calvoter.org where we link to all these. But there's also Vote 411 from the League of Women Voters, which is a new site. It was prior the Voters Edge site that a lot of us utilized. That's now turned into vote411.org. And you can also go to ballopedia.org. And both of these are nonprofit, nonpartisan sites where you enter your address and it will show you all the contests on your ballot. And for many of those contests, it will show you candidate profile, who's endorsed them. You know, they answer various questions. So it's a really great way to drill down and get into that detailed information voters want. And then just real quick to remind voters, your county voter information guide has statements from local candidates and has pro and con arguments for local measures. So look there too.
And still, the central committee, like, what does it actually do? Just to make sure you answer that question.
I mean, essentially, the most important thing to remember with a party board, like the Democratic Party board is essentially what it is, or a Republican Party board, they make endorsements. So, you know, in the Democratic Party in San Francisco, for instance, there's a war right now between the progressive slate and the moderate slate, and which slate wins may determine which candidates get endorsements in future races, and that can deliver 8% of the vote.
Huh. Is that what it is? An endorsement from the party?
Yeah, exactly. It's like Democratic Party Board endorses so-and-so for mayor.
Yeah. That's so interesting. We're talking about what's on the March primary ballot with Guy Marzorati, Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, and Annalise Finney from KQED, as well as Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. What questions do you have about this ballot? What races are you watching? Have you been getting any really annoying mailers or text messages? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrid. We're joined by Kim Alexander, president and founder of California Voter Foundation, and a crew from KQED. Guy Marzorati is correspondent with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a reporter and producer covering politics. Annalise Finney is a reporter with KQED. All the reporting and more you can find at kqed.org/voter guide. There are bunch of folks who want to talk about Proposition 1, perhaps unsurprisingly. One listener writes, I care very much about vets, homeless people, homeless mentally ill people that need treatment, basically any issue that progressives support. However, I'm hearing alarm bells about Prop 1. Considering what Prop 1 does, what is the cost per basis? Is this the best deal we can get? Is it $200,000 per bed? How are we going to get the right people hired to work in supportive roles for the mentally ill and homeless? Is it right that Newsom put this on the March ballot when the turnout will be so low? So we've got a lot of questions about Prop 1, skeptical of the tactics, of the strategy, and maybe even of the intent right there. What do you
think? Yeah, I mean, I would label all three of those like known unknowns, right? That is a question going forward, the mental health care workforce. It is a question going forward, like where these sites, you know, ultimately end up if Prop 1 passes. And also the turnout is like, that was a bet Newsom made. He cleared out the field for this primary. He wanted to have the only measure on the ballot, knowing that the turnout would be more conservative than November. Maybe not this conservative. I don't know if he was thinking about this, but he definitely felt like, okay, there's an urgency to this. We want to get this passed as quickly as possible. And it's a dice roll because you are dealing with an electorate that might be more skeptical of this kind of spending, you know, than if this was on the ballot in November.
Another listener writes, if you remove the bond from Proposition 1, why do we need to go to voters to make policy changes in how we solve social problems? Is this just another artifact of the proposition system where a poorly written law, in this case Prop 63, ends up being too difficult or impossible to amend? This feels like the same kind of failure as repeatedly asking for my opinion on kidney dialysis every election cycle.
Oh, yes. I'm getting like PTSD, kidney dialysis. No, the reason you have to go back to the ballot is because this was passed by voters initially, Prop 63. So to make a change to that, you have to go back to voters. And I think the argument would be not necessarily that this was even, you know, Daryl Steinberg, for example, mayor of Sacramento, he was the author of Prop 63 back in 2004. And he's like, it has worked. It's brought in a lot of money for programs. His argument now to shift and to pass Prop 1 is it's just not focusing enough on housing. So I think rather than like a cleanup measure, I think the supporters of Prop 1 say we've given an honest evaluation of the Mental Health Services Act. It's been 20 years. We just want to take this in a new direction.
But that general critique of propositions, like why are we voting on these versus people passing them, that's also really showing its head in San Francisco too. Proposition B is about voting on police staffing levels. Proposition E, which we haven't even touched on yet, is like, you know, voting on police policy, like vehicle pursuits. Like why are voters voting on whether or not police should be doing vehicle pursuits? Like
that's... Or that algebra advisory measure doesn't even like actually change anything. Yeah.
I'll vote on my kid's math.
I mean, I am interested in, let's talk about Proposition E. Tell us about what it actually would do or what it would change. I mean, we had Mayor Breed on last week and she was saying, you know, it wouldn't necessarily just be car pursuits. It would also allow us to use drones to pursue people, you know, a la kind of LAPD helicopters. Tell us more about Proposition E.
So this is what is so amazing about Proposition E is, like so many different ballot measures, you can very easily sum it up with just a line, right? And I was trying to explain to my mom what Prop E was the other day because she was asking me how to, you know, what am I voting on? Mm-hmm. And there's really such a grab bag of things in it. It's police surveillance powers, essentially skipping approvals with the Board of Supervisors. It's vehicle pursuits, expanding their ability to do so. It's also paperwork, reducing the amount of paperwork that officers have to do in use of force incidents, which also is what some people say needed oversight. And it's also weakening the police commission, adding some power to the police department to slow roll any changes coming from the citizen-led police commission.
It's wild. I mean, listening to you talk about Prop E, like this primary really crystallizes to me the shift in public safety politics in the Bay Area. Like November 2020, there were six ballot measures in the Bay Area trying to reform law enforcement. Most of that, like increasing police oversight. There was one in SF to undo the minimum staffing requirement for police, all passed by huge margins. Like that was not 10 years ago. No. That was less than 4 years ago. Could you imagine those measures like on the ballot passing today?
Such a swing.
The swing has been so quick, it seems like, in the last few years to now where you have San Francisco, this is a measure to reform police. I wouldn't call it police reform in the way that we use that phrase. You have the staffing requirement going the other way in San Francisco. You have, you know, in the South Bay, it seems like every person running for city council is talking about changing Prop 47, even though they have absolutely no ability to do that on the city council. It's just like it is such a pendulum
swing. Yeah. You know, Alameda County has been one of the hotbeds of police reform for quite a long time, or attempted police reform. Are there things on the ballot in that realm right now?
You know, there aren't any measures like Measure E, but there it is something that's coming up in a lot of what we're seeing in the state Senate race for Nancy Skinner's old seat, and then also something we're seeing in supervisors' races. As we spoke about a little before, there's two kind of close supervisors' races, and public safety is a big part of that. In the board supervisor, President Nate Miley, is facing a tough challenge from a newcomer whose name is Jennifer Esteen. And she's really holding his feet to the fire on the kind of slow walk Alameda has had to establish a civilian oversight board for the sheriff. So this is kind of the opposite direction that we're seeing in other parts of the Bay Area. But it is still part of the conversation, just slightly different.
Well, and if Miley, you know, walks off with that race, you know, that issue will make away a little bit, right?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Let's bring in Robert in San Francisco. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, thank you. I was calling in regard to Proposition C, which would waive the transfer tax on office to residential conversions for the next 10 years. I happen to be a strategy advisor to an architectural firm here in San Francisco. We need to satisfy the state-mandated housing element of adding 82,000 homes in the next 7 years. This would be an integral part of it, not only in helping to satisfy the housing element and creating housing at all income levels, but also to somewhat kindle downtown into more of a 24/7, 365 neighborhood and create more eyes on the street, if you will, or more safety.
Yeah. Robert, let me ask you this really quickly. Just as someone who, Robert, just as someone who does this, I mean, how much is waiving a tax like this? Like, how much of a difference does this make? Like, do you think it is a meaningful change?
Would help the projects pencil out. Yes, there is a state grant of it, state grants available. There's a pool of roughly $400 million in state grant for such a program, but it seems to be involving a lot of bureaucracy and red tape. And a lot of the developers claim that you have to do a lot of surgery to a lot of these older buildings, you know, particularly like what you're seeing with the Warfield building or the former Humboldt Bank building. So there are the construction costs and the, the challenge for a lot of developers is to be able to get these projects to quote unquote pencil out.
Robert, hey, thanks so much. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, you want to talk about this?
Yeah, this is like exempting certain office conversions into housing from transfer taxes to kind of, you know, make it a little more lucrative to so we can get more housing.
Grease the wheels on moving some of these things.
Right, but you know, the city controller's office issued a report casting a little doubt that maybe this would be enough to make projects get over the hump and make it over to really pencil out as we're talking about. And the other thing is that it is a little bit, you know, troublesome to convert this offices into housing because we lose a lot of revenue. The report also found that for every 100,000 square feet of office space we lose, that's a hit to $49 million of San Francisco's GDP, which is huge. And we depend on those taxes for all the services and programs we offer. So we do need to revitalize downtown, but we always have to understand the trade-offs too.
Wait, hold on. Tell me again. What was that ratio again? 100,000
square feet of office space, $49 million GDP loss.
Oh my gosh. But we have an enormous amount of office space, like millions of feet of office space, right? That's empty.
Empty, right. So you have to be surgical. You have to be careful. But not all those offices can be converted. There's issues with, as your previous shows have highlighted, bathrooms and light and the organization
of the buildings.
Floor
plates aren't right and they have to punch holes in the thing. And yeah, I know. Wow, it's fascinating.
We're all armchair architects now.
Those are kind of scary. It's kind of scary numbers. Let's bring in Mona in Hayward. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mona.
My question is regarding the temporary Senate seat versus the six-year Senate seat. We have three Democratic congressmen running for the temporary and also for the six-year. But if one of those is elected for the temporary, does that not decrease our ability in Congress to do anything from November until January?
No, sorry, say they decrease our chances to do something. They would still,
the number of Democratic congressmen versus Republican right now is very, very tight. And we are taking away another Democratic congressman if they are elected into the temporary position of Senate starting November 4th. Isn't that not correct?
Yes. Oh, I see. In the House. Yeah. So there would be a vacancy then if, like, for example, right, if Adam Schiff, you know, Katie Porter were to have that short-term Senate seat and get sworn in right after certification, yeah, there would be a window from probably first week of December to maybe first week of January where Democrats would be down a vote in the House. Now, I don't know if there's anything that can be done to speed up the swearing in of a House member to replace those folks. But you're right in the sense that they would have to take off. They would take office earlier than, you know, the rest of the senators who win in November.
That's interesting.
And that's,
we
that's
have a lot of, my curious, I'm curious, would we have a lot of activity in Congress between December and January? Is it really going to matter?
That's a good question. I mean, in the past, there have been, like, you know, lame duck productivity, you know, people feeling like they have nothing to lose politically, they can bargain. But we've also seen folks want to get out of town.
That time during 2020, 2021. Yeah. Mona, that's a great point. Thanks for bringing that out. You know, Kenichi over on the Discord wants to know, you know, differences among the U.S. Senate candidates on issues of their potential effectiveness in the Senate. You know, doesn't really care about who can raise money, but who, you know, their policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think I see the differences more, you know, stylistic, certainly between Porter and Schiff. I think Porter is someone who, you know, likes, she's running on kind of a reform message, and certainly her activity as a House member has been, you know, emphasis on oversight. I think the biggest policy difference that we've seen articulated during the course of this campaign has been on Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, where Barbara Lee came out right from the beginning almost calling for an immediate ceasefire. Porter kind of hedged a little bit over the next few months and said, you know, she's for a ceasefire, but listed a lot of really difficult conditions to meeting that. And then you have Schiff on the other end of the spectrum, who has been really, you know, pro-Israel, has opposed a ceasefire. So in terms of, like, that's been the biggest policy difference that we've seen play out over the last few months.
Let's bring in caller Angela in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I had a question. I was wondering if you all could talk a bit more about the PACs, like Grow SF, Together SF, and Stop Crime SF. Mm-hmm. I've been receiving a lot of mailers, and I've seen those posters hanging up, and I think they really send a mixed message. And I was wondering if you all could talk a bit about that.
Angela, thanks so much for that question. Joe?
Yeah, so we've really seen this kind of cropping up of essentially super PACs in San Francisco donating to a whole range of moderate Democrat campaigns and propositions to help them. A number of these are, like, funded by tech CEOs like angel investor Ron Conway, Chris Larson, the CEO of Ripple. And we're seeing this whole network come out. I wholly recommend folks Google this great Guardian piece that really outlines a lot of the connections between those PACs. But really what we're seeing them do is prop up ballot propositions of moderate allies. So the propositions on San Francisco's ballot in some way are a proxy battle for the mayor's race to come in November. Mayor Breed authored propositions E and F, which are really about burnishing her bona fides in public safety. Candidate Asha Safai, who's a supervisor running for mayor, put up Prop B. So all these are kind of like, we want to look good before the mayor's race. And these kind of super PACs are really supporting a lot of these issues in order to make that happen.
And we now have Supervisor Peskin, right, who's getting in on the mayor's race.
Very possible. He hasn't officially declared yet. All the signs are pointing to he's very much looking into it.
Yeah. Well, you know. Just saw him last week. He didn't mention anything weird. We have Rocky writes, I'm curious to know Kim and others' perspectives on why we're still doing a March primary. Since 2000, we've held March, quote, Super Tuesday primaries. A June primary gives more time for Congress members to decide to retire, and the shorter and cheaper general elections help diverse and less establishment candidates win. Isn't the low turnout a clear message to move our presidential primaries to June? Kim, what do you think?
Oh, this is such a great question. All your callers' questions are great questions, actually. But I mean, people are wondering that. I think the disadvantage of having the primary in March is that you have elections offices sending ballot materials and information about your ballot, you know, over the holidays. And a lot of people just don't really connect with that. And then you've got weather issues. I mean, we've had this major, you know, storm in Northern California that's shut down a lot of Truckee and some of the, you know, other northern parts of the state. So definitely having it, you know, in a milder time of year is an advantage. You know, we did this because we wanted California to have more of a say. We're the biggest state in the country, and we were finding having our primaries later in the year, we didn't have as much of a voice. And we have had, you know, some of a say in the last couple of primaries. So, you know, but we did have the primary in June in 2016, and it was still competitive by the time it came to California. So it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. And in any event, I hope people do vote. I know it's not the most exciting election presidentially that we've had, but as you could hear from everybody talking on this show today, there are so many important contests. And I always want to remind people, you know, it's not a test. If there's something on the ballot you're not sure about, you don't feel comfortable making a choice, you don't want to make the wrong choice, just skip that measure, go on to the next measure.
It's not the SAT. Yeah, thank you, Kim.
Be a voter. That's the message, is be a voter.
Real quick, round the horn here with our KQED folks. What's the one election that you're going to be watching most closely come tomorrow? And let's start with you, Annalise.
You know, this one is going to sound a little off in the weeds, but I think the one I'm the most focused on is Measure B in Alameda County. This is the measure that I mentioned before that's going to change this county's recall rules. And I think what's interesting about that measure in particular is that it reflects a shift we're seeing statewide, where people are sort of pushing back against this wave of recalls that we're seeing. At the state level, after the Newsom recall, which cost the state upward of $2 million, we saw two reform efforts pass in state legislature. There's another one pending this year that would change the rules and kind of rein in how many signatures are required to get a recall on the ballot. What questions those ballot ask voters? So instead of saying, you know, do you want to recall this person and who would you choose to replace them? The ballots will now just say, do you want to recall this person? And then elected officials would appoint somebody until another election can happen. But
that's super interesting.
What's interesting about this in Alameda County is it's the county sort of trying to bring these reforms to Alameda County, especially as we're seeing an uptick of recalls here. I mean, Alameda County voters may soon weigh in on five different recalls, which is a lot.
Gosh. Wow. So, Joe, what are you watching?
Public safety, like, do voters vote along with fears of crime, and that's in the propositions and the judges race, or has that cooled off a little bit? And and I wonder, and you can really track that in some of these props and the judges race.
Supervisor races with only two candidates. It is not a primary. It is not a drill. The winner will take office, and that's especially true in Alameda and Napa, where there are no term limits. So if you're voting for supervisor in Napa, you're picking someone for years to come.
Oh, interesting. All right, check that out and everything else at kqed.org/voterguide. We've been joined by our crack KQED team, Annalise Finney, Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, and Guy Marzorati. Thank you so much.
Happy voting.
We've also been joined by Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. Thank you so much, Kim.
My pleasure.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with guest host Leslie McClurg.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.